again. It's good singing tonight, and it's good to see so many of you come out this Monday evening for the outset of this week of meetings, and we trust the Lord bless you as we continue through the week. I do encourage you to come out each evening if you possibly can. We'll be building each night as we go along upon what was said the previous evening, and I hope the Lord will indeed thrill your heart as we look into his word and to see all that he has laid up for us, or much of what he has laid up for us with respect to the future. We're in the book of Ezekiel tonight, Ezekiel chapter 40, Ezekiel chapter 40, and we're going to begin our reading in verse 1, Ezekiel chapter 40 and verse 1. And we're just going to read four verses of Scripture. We will be really in the last few chapters of Ezekiel throughout the week, from chapter 40 all the way to chapter 48. So it'll be a familiar territory for you, I hope, by the end of the week. But here we are in Ezekiel chapter 40, beginning in verse 1. And it says, "In the 25th year of our captivity, in the beginning of the year, in the 10th day of the month, in the 14th year after that the city was smitten, in the selfsame day, the hand of the Lord was upon me and brought me thither. In the visions of God brought he me into the land of Israel and set me upon a very high mountain, by which was as the frame of a city on the south. And he brought me thither, and behold, there was a man whose appearance was like the appearance of brass, with a line of flex in his hand and a measuring reed, and he stood in the gate. And the man said unto me, Son of man, behold with thine eyes and hear with thine ears, and set thine heart upon all that I shall show thee. For to the intent that I might show them unto thee art thou brought hither. Declare all that thou seest to the house of Israel." We trust the Lord will add his blessing to the reading of his precious word. Ezekiel was a priest and a prophet of God who lived in the last days of the kingdom of Judah, and was among the first of those taken by Nebuchadnezzar from Judah as a captive to Babylon. He ministered to those Jewish captives who were exiled from their homeland as a consequence of God's judgment upon their land through their idolatry. And at first, these exiles, believing the message of the false prophets that there would be no such judgment, they believed and assumed that their stay in Babylon would be but a short-term thing. But Ezekiel wanted to convince them that because of their sin against God, the fact would be that they would remain in the land of Babylon for every day of the 70 years predicted by those faithful prophets such as Isaiah and Jeremiah. Now, as we open to chapter 40, we find Ezekiel is in the 25th year of his captivity. That's the opening line, in the 25th year of our captivity. All this time, Ezekiel has been preaching to these people by means of object lesson, that the people had been judged, that there would be no swift return to Jerusalem, to their homeland. And by now, this message is beginning to sink in. It's really a very gloomy message as far as the hearer was concerned. It was somewhat, to their ears, a hopeless message that there would be no sudden return to Judah or to Jerusalem. And so the people are disheartened. Worse than that, their entire faith has been laid bare and open to question. You see, the whole of Israelite history is taken up with the thought of a coming Messiah, the prospect of his arrival, and indeed of the establishment of his kingdom. The Jews were looking for a Messiah. They're still looking for a Messiah. But for Messiah to come,
There had to be a throne for him to come to. And that throne had to be situated in the temple. And so with no temple in place, there was no likelihood of a kingdom at that point and no prospect of a Messiah coming. And it appears that they have been the victims of a grand delusion, that their national aspirations and hopes of a messianic kingdom were fast failing and was nothing more than mere wishful thinking. What then did the future hold for Jerusalem and Israel? Well, this was the burning question of the hour. And the answer came in the form of Ezekiel's vision from chapter 40 onward. This indeed is a message of hope to the Jews of the captivity. Here is proof positive that God's plans are never thwarted by human weakness or even by our sin. Now, I want to begin this evening by just looking at this vision and considering an explanation of Ezekiel's vision. In verse 2, Ezekiel tells us he was brought by a vision to the land of Israel. Physically, he is in Babylon. Make no mistake about that. But he was given a revelation, a mental picture, if you like, whereby the Spirit of God took him to the land of Israel. And in this vision, he is set down upon a high mountain. And that mountain is considered to be Mount Scopus, part of the mountain range that forms, that takes in the Mount of Olives. So it's really the northern extension of the Mount of Olives. He's brought to the east of Jerusalem, and he's set down upon the Mount of Olives to make some observation. And lying to the south of the city, or of the mountain, notice there was the frame of a city on the south. And there's no prizes tonight for indeed guessing which city that might be. There's only one city that sits upon the heart of the people of Judah of old, and of course that's Jerusalem. Now notice in verse 3 that in his vision, Ezekiel encounters a man with a line of flax in his hand and a measuring reed. Now, these are the tools of an ancient surveyor. A line of flax, a linen cord, was used much like we would use a modern tape measure. It was simply a long rope with knots tied in, each one a cubit apart. And so for long measurements, a surveyor would come along and he would pull that rope out and he would measure how many cubits a thing needed to be or a thing was. So this was basically a measuring tape. We would think of it in those terms. The reed in question, or a rod if you like, is akin to our meter stick or yardstick. And so the rod was 6.5 cubits long. We're told that in verse 5. And here we need a little explanation. Because any time you hear the measurement of a cubit defined, and you're going to be hearing a lot about cubits in the next few days, but any time you hear the word cubit defined, it's usually given as approximately 18 inches or half a meter. And that's because it is traditionally taken to be the length from your elbow to the tip of your middle finger, which is on average about 18 inches for most people. And that's a short cubit. But this is in contrast to what the next chapter calls a great cubit, or a royal cubit, or a Babylonian cubit sometimes, which is a little bit longer than the average cubit, roughly 21 inches in length. So bearing in mind that Ezekiel is in Babylon, that he's writing to people who are now living there, it seems very likely that he used the longer cubit in his measurement. So the rod, or the reed, is taken to be 10.5 feet long, 6 cubits long, 10.5 feet long, roughly about 3.2 meters. And it was used, as you might use a yardstick, by constantly laying it down and turning it over on itself. And you could measure a certain distance by that means. Now, when a person measures something, it is a signal of possession or of ownership. Do you ever realize that? You know, if you were to invite me to your house for tea, and I were to come to your house for tea, by the way, this is not fielding. I'm not trying to get an invitation here. But if I were to come to your house for tea, and you were to nip out into the kitchen to put the teapot on, and you came back into the living room and you found me with a tape measure measuring your curtains or measuring your flooring or something, I think you would immediately say, well, what are you doing? Why are you measuring up? And if I were to say, I'm measuring up for some new curtains, you'd say, well, that's outrageous. It's not your house. I like my curtains. But if I were to come into your house and find you with a measuring rod or a measuring tape, measuring the curtains or measuring the flooring, well, that would be of no concern to me because it's your property. And you would be perfectly entitled as the owner of it to make those measurements. So when a person is measuring something up, it's really a signal of possession, of ownership. Look with me for a moment in Revelation chapter 11 and verses 1 and 2. Remember, we're at the midway point of the tribulation as we spoke about yesterday morning. And here we have a revelation of another future temple yet to come, not the one that is the focus of Ezekiel's prophecy, but one that nevertheless is yet future, the temple which we believe the Antichrist shall enter and in which he shall perform the abomination of the desolation. But here in verse 1 of chapter 11 in Revelation, it says, there was given to me a reed like unto a rod. And the angel stood, saying, rise and measure the temple of God and the altar and them that worship therein. But the court which is without the temple, leave out and measure it not. For it is given unto the Gentiles, and the holy city shall they tread underfoot 42 months. So here we see that God is the rightful owner of that piece of real estate, and that he is giving the instruction for that temple area to be measured. Look also in Zechariah and chapter 2, the book of Zechariah and chapter 2. Zechariah, of course, is a post-exilic prophet. He writes after the people have returned from Babylon, and he's encouraging them, and particularly encouraging Zerubbabel as governor of Babylon or governor of Judah to get on with the building of the temple. And it says here in verses 1 and 2 of Zechariah chapter 2, I lifted up mine eyes again and looked, and behold, a man with a measuring line in his hand. Then said I, whither goest thou? Where are you going with that thing? And he said unto me, to measure Jerusalem, to see what is the breadth thereof and what is the length thereof. And again, we see the Lord is here presenting himself as the one who is the king of that city. This is his holy city. This is the place where he shall reign from. So in Ezekiel's prophecy, the Lord has sent a surveyor on site, and Ezekiel is instructed to pay careful attention to all that is about to be revealed. Notice verse 4 of Ezekiel chapter 4. It says, son of man, behold with thine eyes, observe what's going on, hear with thine ears, set thine heart upon all that I shall show thee, for the intent that I might show them unto thee art thou brought hither. Declare all that thou seest to the house of Israel. So Ezekiel has been brought by means of a vision from Babylon to Israel that he might declare all that has been seen to the captives back in Babylon. Now the purpose of this vision is to bring those Jewish people to their senses, to awaken them to their sin, to show them how much the Lord loves them and how desperately they have violated that law. Look at Ezekiel chapter 43 with me and verse 10, if you would please. Ezekiel chapter 43 and verse 10. Notice what the prophet writes here. He says, thou, son of man, show the house, that is the temple of God, the house of God, show the house to the house of Israel, to these captives with whom you're dwelling, that they may be, notice, ashamed of their iniquities. Ezekiel's vision in the first place was designed to bring these Israelites to shame. Here is an indication of God's abundant grace in the face of man's abounding sin. They had rejected the Lord. They had loved idols. They had resisted God's word. They had persecuted God's messengers, and yet here is a message now coming from God himself that they still had a future. And that ought to have brought them some measure of shame, because despite their waywardness and despite their sinfulness, the promises of God to them held good. Ezekiel's vision was then to be considered by the Jews, to be meditated upon. Notice again in verse 10 of chapter 43, it says, "And let them," at the end of that verse, "measure the pattern, and if they be ashamed of all that they have done, show them the form of the house, the shape of it, the design, the plan, and the fashion thereof, and the goings out thereof, and the comings in thereof. Show them the gates, and all the forms thereof, and all the ordinances thereof, the functions, and all the forms thereof, and all the laws thereof." By detailing this holy place for them, God was showing them that he is meticulous in his plans and in his promises. Really, he was presenting them with a message of hope. He was saying, your future and my promises will not be thwarted by your present circumstances. You see, they had given up any hope that there would be a temple in Jerusalem. They had given up any hope that they might return back to the land. They thought surely they were stuck in a real pickle. And here God comes along and he says, "Now listen, I want you to understand that despite your sin and your history, despite your idolatry, despite your waywardness, my plans and my promises are holding good for you." In other words, he's affirming his covenant with them. The covenant he made with Abraham, Isaac, and Jacob, and the covenant he made with King David himself. Promise of a land and the promise of a kingdom would be fulfilled. Ezekiel's vision then finally urges them at the tail end of verse 11 to keep the whole form thereof and all the ordinances thereof and to do them. So this refers both to the design and the statutes that surround the temple, just as the pattern of the tabernacle of old had to be painstakingly observed, so too with the temple of tomorrow. It had to be built exactly as described, so that the people were to prepare themselves for it. And the details Ezekiel was given them, and I want you to notice this, was not just for the purpose of information, but it was for the purpose of transformation. The prophet was laying out the prospect of a messianic temple in the hope that it would motivate those people to holy lives. Can I tell you that that's what all good prophetic teaching is about? It's not about tickling your ears. It's not about simply having all kinds of wild and fantasies about the news and conspiracy theories. No, it's about the promises of God. And it ought to encourage us to live lives that are pure and holy and right before him as we think of all that the Lord has planned even for us. Well, having made that brief observation, let's consider the interpretation of Ezekiel's vision. And I make no apologies this evening. I'm going to give you a particular slant, a particular interpretation of Ezekiel's writings. And as I do so, I'm taking a literal, historical, grammatical approach to these scriptures. But you, as you might well know and expect, will find that there are brothers and sisters in Christ who take a very different view. And the closing chapters of Ezekiel really raise difficulties for those who do not or cannot accept the idea that there will be a literal millennial reign for Christ upon the earth. There are those who would see the kingdom as a spiritual one and would see these passages as passages which should be interpreted metaphorically or allegorically. The challenge for those people who heavily criticize the premillennial view is that if you do not take this passage literally, if you do not accept it as it reads, you're really at sea when it comes to understanding these closing chapters of the book of Ezekiel. The rejection of the literal interpretation of these passages is based upon the notion, and really it's a preconceived notion in many cases, that God is forever finished with the nation of Israel, that Israel has now been replaced by the church, and all the promises that are recorded pertaining to Israel have somehow been transferred to the, you and I living in this particular period in time as the church of God. So they say that the church now becomes spiritual Israel. They believe that national Israel in the Old Testament was merely a type of the church, a model of the church, and that the messianic kingdom promised to the nation has no physical earthly reality at all, but is, in their language, realized in a spiritual kingdom. Now, because of this, we find various suggestions abound as to just what exactly Ezekiel might be describing here in chapters 40 to 48 of this prophecy. Some people say, well, maybe Ezekiel is describing a pre-exilic temple. Maybe he's highlighting the temple that used to be prior to the fall of the temple at the hand of Nebuchadnezzar. And so these chapters simply serve as a memorial to that which was lost. But the question must be asked then, that given that the temple of old Solomon's temple is described in such detail throughout the Kings and the Chronicles, why would it even be necessary for Ezekiel to be given a fresh vision of it after it's fallen and to be told to write it all down yet again? You know, I can't think of anything perhaps more cruel. Here are these people in despondency. They're disheartened. They're discouraged. They think the temple is gone and gone forever. And now Ezekiel says, well, here's a picture of what you lost. And I hope that cheers you up. That makes no sense at all. And in any case, the description given of Ezekiel's temple really doesn't marry up with the description that we have of Solomon's temple. There are some very vital and key differences. Well, others say it's not Solomon's temple that's in view, but rather it's Zerubbabel's temple, the second temple that was built in Jerusalem, that's in view. And it's really to that temple where the Jewish remnant will return after the captivity that these scriptures are recorded. Now, you talk about comparing chalk with cheese. You know, the temple Ezekiel describes is far more glorious than the one that Solomon built. And yet the second temple, which Zerubbabel oversaw the erection of, fell far short of Solomon's temple in terms of its structure, so much so that the people who witnessed the first wept when they saw the second. There's also one other key point here. The temple Ezekiel describes would ultimately house the glory of the Lord. Look in Ezekiel chapter 43. We briefly looked at this yesterday morning, and we'll come back to this passage, I'm sure, again before the week is out. But Ezekiel chapter 43, and notice what the prophet writes. He says, afterward, he brought me to the gate, even the gate that looketh toward the east. And behold, notice, the glory of the God of Israel came the way of the east. By the way, the glory here is a person, not just a presence, but it's a person. This is the Lord Jesus coming. And his voice was like the noise of many waters, and the earth shined with his glory. The earth was filled with his glory. And it was according to the appearance of the vision which I saw, even according to the vision that I saw when I came to destroy the city. And the visions were like the vision that I saw by the river Chebar, and I fell upon my face. And the glory of the Lord came into the house by the way of the gate, whose prospect is toward the east. Now, that's an important detail, because if you read the history of Zerubbabel's temple, you'll find no reference to the glory of the Lord inhabiting the Holy of Holies. There is no place in Scripture that is similar to that which Solomon had experienced with his temple, or indeed the tabernacle had experienced before that. And if you recall, Josephus said that in the holy place, in the Holy of Holies, there was nothing whatsoever. It was just an empty, hollow room. So we say this couldn't possibly then be the second temple, for the second temple did not house God's Shekinah glory as this temple will do. So other folks say, well, this is just an ideal temple, one that should have been built after Israel's return from the Babylonian captivity. I remember when I was a young fellow, my mother used to take me and my brothers, and we would go once a year or so to the Ideal Home Exhibition in the King's Hall. I don't think they have that anymore, but it was a wonderful exhibition where you got to go and see beautiful homes that you could never afford. And I often wondered, well, why does my mother bring us here? We never actually buy anything. We go around looking at everything and said, isn't that good? Isn't that great? Look at this, is great. And we always went back to the same old house at the end of the day until next year. Well, that's the idea in this argument. This is an ideal home. If God could have his way, this is how his temple would look. And if that's the case, then what you really have in the last 9 chapters of Ezekiel is nothing more than a utopian dream. It's nothing more than a bit of Jewish idealism, that which will never be fulfilled, which really turns a large tract of God's word into a Jewish fantasy world. And I really don't think that's any way in which we should handle the Scriptures. Others say, well, no, it's a depiction of the eternal state, as described in the last 2 chapters of our Bible, Revelation 21 and 22. Really? But Revelation chapter 21 and verse 22 says explicitly, "And I saw no temple therein, for the Lord God Almighty and the Lamb are the temple of it." So there is no temple in the eternal state. So this temple must somehow relate to time, not to eternity. But by far the most common interpretation is that the temple symbolizes the spiritual blessings experienced by the church during this present age. And those who hold such a view consequently find themselves reading into the text. They find themselves never quite adequately explaining the symbols that they lay under the text. They skip large sections of Ezekiel's prophecy. I have a dear friend over in England, and he preached on Ezekiel. He started in Ezekiel chapter 36. He went through chapter 37, the Valley of Dry Bones. He went into chapters 38 and 39 concerning the coming Islamic invasion of Israel. He didn't touch on any of that because he said he didn't understand it. He got into chapter 40. He says, I don't understand this. It's got something to do with Israel. And he preached from chapter 36 of Ezekiel to chapter 48 of Ezekiel in 35 minutes. And by his own admission, he didn't understand what he was reading. And so he skipped large sections of Ezekiel's prophecy and never fully expounded on these chapters, despite the fact that he was preaching a series on Ezekiel. The only reasonable conclusion we can draw from Ezekiel's words is that this temple is not historical, it's not allegorical, it is literal. We accept it as literal truth and the revealed plan of God for some yet future time. Hence, it's not surprising that Ezekiel's prophecy regarding this temple with its Levitical priesthood, which we'll discuss in the later evenings, in its sacrifices, which we'll discuss on Wednesday night, correlates perfectly with the covenant promises found in the book of Jeremiah. Look with me in Jeremiah chapter 33, if you would. Jeremiah chapter 33. And I want to begin reading here in this chapter in the 17th verse, Jeremiah chapter 33 and verse 17. It says, "For thus saith the Lord, David shall never want a man to sit upon the throne of the house of Israel." This takes us back to the Davidic covenant, the 2 Samuel chapter 7, where God made such a promise to David concerning his son Solomon and his descendants thereafter. He says, "Neither shall the priests, the Levites, want a man before me to offer burnt offerings and to kindle meat offerings and to do sacrifice continually." And the word of the Lord came unto Jeremiah, saying, "Thus saith the Lord, if you can break my covenant of the day and my covenant of the night, that there should be no day, that there should not be day and night in their season, then may also my covenant be broken with David my servant, that he should not have a son to reign upon his throne, and with the Levites, the priests, my ministers." So here we have a marrying of the two offices, the offices of king and priest, that in some way satisfies the wants and the aspirations of those who previously held those positions. Interesting. There would always be a priesthood, and there would always be a kingship. And in doing this, God was somehow fulfilling his word to past generations. So we conclude that it's an actual future temple that Ezekiel is describing to us in some degree of detail. Now, understand that the millennial kingdom is an extension of the past Jewish age. And though it embraces the Gentile nations, and we who are Gentiles will certainly benefit under it and during it, nevertheless, it operates primarily as a Jewish system under the theocratic laws of the new covenant, with Christ sitting and reigning from his throne, from the throne of David, as prophesied in both Old and New Testaments. In actual fact, if you look with me in the book of Acts, Acts chapter 15, Acts chapter 15, we come to the council at Jerusalem, in which there was some degree of trouble in the minds of the believers at the church at Jerusalem, because the Gentiles at Antioch, Syria, had been saved and were being ministered to by Paul and by Barnabas. And they were concerned that in seeing this event unfold, these Gentiles were not surrendering themselves to the law as they understood it, particularly to circumcision. And they wanted to know what was the way forward, what was to become of these Gentiles, and how were they to be responsible to the law of the Jew. And here we come to verse 14 of this chapter, and James is speaking, the pastor of the church, and James is speaking, and he says, "Simeon hath declared how God at the first did visit the Gentiles and take out of them a people for his name." That's a reference to the church at Antioch, Syria. "And to this agree the words of the prophet, as it is written." Now notice the phrase, "After this I will return." After this, I will return. After what? After that God takes out for himself a people from among the Gentiles. "After this, I will return and will build again the tabernacle of David, which has fallen down. And I will build again the ruins thereof, and I will set it up, that the residue of men might seek after the Lord, and all the Gentiles upon whom my name is called, saith the Lord, who doeth all these things. Known unto God are all his works from the beginning of the world." And what he's really saying to these Jewish believers who are in his congregation is this: look, you folks who are getting very agitated about the Gentiles and they're coming into the church and you're concerned that somehow or other you're going to have your own Judaism eroded and you're going to lose your identity, understand this: at the end of time, God is going to build a house, a temple, and all the nations are going to gather unto it, Jew and Gentile, in the worship of the one who sits upon the throne. Now, let's take a few moments and just observe Ezekiel's vision. We'll make an observation
of this vision. We've thought of an explanation and of an interpretation. We want to consider our observation from Ezekiel's vision. Now, I have brought with me tonight, and I hope you got one on the way out, and the way in rather, a handout in which you have a plan of Ezekiel's temple laid before you on one side, and then on the other side you have a plan of the northern and eastern gates of this temple. And so I'll be making reference to that. I'm not giving you any homework. You don't have to worry. I'm not going to ask you to write any essays or anything like that. But just follow along. And it's actually something that you can take home. I didn't think about doing it on the overhead, but I thought it's much better if you can take this home and have it and keep it and refer to it in the days ahead. So before we get into the nitty-gritty of the coming temple, let's just take a brief overview of its precincts, beginning with the wall. And you'll see that marked with the letter A on your little map there, on your plan. And on chapter 40 and verse 5 of Ezekiel's prophecy, we read, "And behold, a wall on the outside of the house round about, and in the man's hand a measuring reed or rod of 6 cubits long by the cubit and a handbreadth. And so he measured the breadth of the building, 1 reed, and the height, 1 reed. So we read of this wall that is surrounding the house of the Lord. And, there's always been a wall that has gone around the temple of the Lord, and indeed the tabernacle of the Lord. And the millennial temple is no different in that respect. This is the first measurement that Ezekiel is given. And notice the wall is as deep as it is high. It's precisely 1 reed, thus making it 10.5 feet, or if you're working in meters, that's about 3.2 meters. And this wall surrounds the entire perimeter of the campus of the temple, and it's marked out by a distance of some 500 cubits by 500 cubits. According to chapter 45 and verse 2, that's some 875 feet square or 267 meters square. Now, I know some of you are sitting there going, cubits, meters, inches, I don't know what you're talking about. I remember preaching this in our church, and my wife came to me afterwards and says, she says, "I'm all cubited out." And maybe you're getting all cubited out. Well, don't panic, okay? Don't panic. Because what we really are seeing here, just to help you visualize it in your mind, in respect to that outer perimeter, it's about the length, 2.5 times the length of the average football pitch. So if you can picture a football pitch, put on its end twice over and then half again, you get an idea of the length of that wall all the way around. And then just as before, we read of an eastern gate, and that's at point B on your handout. Sometimes it's called the beautiful gate or the golden gate. Let's look at chapter 40 now and pick up in verse 6, and we read of that gate. It says, "Then he came unto the gate which looketh toward the east, and went up the stairs thereof." So you rise up into this gate. "And measured the threshold of the gate, which was 1 reed broad, and the other threshold of the gate, which was 1 reed broad. And every little chamber was 1 reed long and 1 reed broad, and between the little chambers were 5 cubits. And the threshold of the gate by the porch of the gate within was 1 reed. He measured also the porch of the gate within 1 reed. Then measured he the porch of the gate 8 cubits, and the post thereof 2 cubits. And the porch of the gate was inward. And the little chambers of the gate eastward were 3 on this side and 3 on that side. They 3 were of 1 measure, and the post had 1 measure on this side and on that side. And he measured the breadth of the entry of the gate 10 cubits, and the length of the gate 13 cubits. The space also before the little chambers was 1 cubit on this side, and the space was 1 cubit on that side. And the little chambers were 6 cubits on this side and 6 cubits on that side. And he measured them, the gate, from the roof of one little chamber to the roof of another. The breadth was 25 cubits, door against door. He made also posts of 60 cubits, even unto the post of the court round about the gate. And from the face of the gate of the entrance unto the face of the porch of the inner gate were 50 cubits. And there were narrow windows to the little chambers and to their posts within the gate round about. And likewise to the arches and windows were round about inward, and upon each post were
palm trees. Now, as before, this is by far the most significant gate in the whole complex. Now, when we say gate, I don't want you to have in your head the idea of your garden gate or, you know, even the grand gates at Buckingham Palace or some stately home. No, rather, when the Bible is using the term gate here, it's really speaking about a small building, what we would refer to as a gatehouse. And the surveying angel takes his measuring rod and he assesses that the outer wall of this gate is the same thickness as the surrounding wall, 10.5 feet, 6 cubits. Then having passed through the gate, the prophet comes to a small room, which is 1 reed long and 1 reed in breadth. Again, 10.5 feet square, 3.2 meters square. And in fact, there are 6 such rooms in this building. If you look at the reverse side of your sheet, you'll see a plan of the eastern gate, and you'll get an idea of that which I'm speaking of this evening. And so there's these 6 rooms in this gatehouse, 3 either side of the passage, and each house has narrow windows, and we're told that those windows are rather like the arrow slits that you would see in a Norman castle. And this gate, and indeed the other gates in the temple complex, will have towers built into them. And the one thing that we know is that these towers will reach a height of 60 cubits. Verse 14 said that, 105 feet tall, or 32 meters tall. So you have these grand entrances as you're coming into the outer courtyard of this temple complex, which is where we go to next. Look in verse 17 of chapter 14. Then brought he me into the outward or outer court, and lo, there were chambers and a pavement made for the court round about. 30 chambers were upon the pavement, and the pavement by the side of the gates over against the length of the gate was the lower pavement. And then he measured the breadth from the forefront of the lower gate onto the forefront of the inner court without, and 100 cubits eastward and northward. And the gate of the outward court that looked toward the north, he measured the length thereof and the breadth thereof, and the little chambers thereof were 3 in this side and 3 in that side, and the posts thereof and the arches thereof were after the measure of the first gate. The length thereof was 50 cubits, and the breadth 25 cubits. And their windows and their arches and their palm trees were after the measure of the gate that looks toward the east, and they went up into it by 7 steps. And the arches thereof were before them. And the gate of the inner court was over against the gate toward the north and toward the east. And he measured from gate to gate 100 cubits. And after they brought me toward the south, behold, a gate toward the south. He measured the posts thereof, the arches thereof, according to these measures. And there were windows in it, and in the arches thereof round about, like those windows, the length was 50 cubits, and the breadth 25 cubits, and there were 7 steps to go up to it, and the arches thereof were before them, and had palm trees, one on this side, another on that side, upon the post thereof, and there was a gate in the inner court toward the south, and he measured from gate to gate toward the south, 100 cubits. Now you get to understand why my wife says you got cubited out, don't you? It's not an easy read. It's not the kind of thing you can just sit down and just go through in a few moments and think, well, I've got a handle on that. This is very specific detail. God is being very careful. He's being very meticulous. You see, God is a God of order. And there's an order to this thing. And so as we come into this outer court area, we become inside the temple area proper, where Ezekiel speaks to us of a pavement, which he calls the lower pavement. Now, that's a little bit deceptive in its title, because you go up steps in the first place into the gatehouse, and then you continue on to the lower pavement. So each time as you head toward the very holy place, you're stepping up, and you're stepping up, and you're stepping up. So don't be deceived by the word or the phrase lower pavement. You're stepping up. It's only lower than the inner court. It's not lower than the outward surroundings. Ezekiel then points out that there are chambers in the north and the south and the east wall. 10 chambers in all, and each rather, making 30 chambers in all. And that's at point D on your main plan, on your handout. And although we're given no indication as to the purpose of these particular rooms, we're told that built into the four corners of the walls are kitchen areas, which are marked with a double C on your handout. Let's look at Ezekiel chapter 46 and verse 19. Ezekiel chapter 46 and verse 19. It says, afterward he brought me through the entry, which was at the side of the gate, into the holy chambers of the priests, which looked toward the north, and behold, there was a place on the two sides westward. Then said he unto me, this is the place where the priests, notice, shall boil the trespass offering and the sin offering, where they shall bake the meat offering, that they bear them not out into the utter court to sanctify the people. Then he brought me forth into the utter court, and caused me to pass by the four corners of the court, marked with that double C. And behold, in every corner of the court there was a court. In the four corners of the court there were courts joined of 40 cubits long and 30 broad. These four corners were of one measure, and there was a row of building round about them four, and it was made with boiling places under the rows round about. Then he said unto me, these are the places of them that boil, where the ministers of the house shall boil the sacrifice of the people. So we understand those four chambers, those four rooms in the corner of the outer court of the temple to come, is where the sacrifices are going to be prepared, so that they may indeed be then, we may indeed find then that the 30 chambers that surround the three walls are actually dining rooms that are in some way related to these sacrifices. Remember, some sacrifices, such as the peace offering, required the worshipers to eat together as part of the ceremony. And it's likely that those chambers you see around the outer part of the wall are there to make provision of dining areas to that end. And finally, Ezekiel tells us the measurement from the inner court to the outer court, and it's the same all the way around. 100 cubits, or if you like, 175 feet. Now, I am, by profession, a draftsman. I tell you that because I like blueprints. And I know that some people simply don't like blueprints. They can't make head nor tail of a plan. And so it may not be up your street. And I appreciate that may not be everybody's cup of tea. But what I want you to go home with tonight is simply this, that what we're looking at here is a literal structure. An actual building that has yet to be erected someday. This is not some allegorization. This is not some divine pipe dream. It is not some kind of mysterious parable whereby great spiritual truths are spiritualized. This is the coming temple of the Lord. And why I want you to realize that this is a literal building is that someday, if you're a believer, you will see it. You're going to see it. You know, a year or so ago, I was walking over to Tesco's. And a woman came down the street, a rather elderly woman. She came down the street pushing a little shopping bag. And she stopped me in the street. And I thought she was going to ask me for some help of some kind. And she says, excuse me. And I said, yes. She says, may I invite you to this? And she produced a watchtower leaflet with a picture of the kingdom as is typically represented by the Jehovah's Witnesses, that was of a picnic scene with families enjoying a nice sunny day out in a park. And she began to speak to me about the kingdom. And I remember thinking, of all the people in Stoke that you could have stopped to talk about the kingdom, probably I was not your best choice. But anyway, I listened patiently to this dear lady, bless her heart. And I said to her, you know, that's a wonderful picture that you have on this sheet of paper. I said, but there's one thing missing. She says, well, what do you mean? I says, well, there's a very important feature of the kingdom that doesn't appear on your illustration. She says, well, what do you mean? I says, well, what about the temple? Where is the temple that Ezekiel speaks of? Why is it not featured in your illustration? And you know, she looked at me like a cow looking at a new gate. She seemed to have no idea what I was talking about. And so I began to lead her through this passage from memory, started to lead her through this passage and explain to her about Ezekiel's vision. And I said to her, you know, why? Why do you think Ezekiel has spoken of such a structure, of such a building? Why do you think that God would have such an edifice as this at the heart of his kingdom? And you know what she said to me? And this was breathtaking. She said, well, I suppose it must be to store watchtowers in. And my jaw hit the floor. And I says, dear, I don't think that's what God is going to do with his temple in the kingdom age. I said, that's where the Messiah is coming. And he's going to sit there upon his throne. And I told her what I'll tell you this evening. If you want to see it, you must be born again. You see, it doesn't matter how good you are. This was a lovely lady. She was gracious. She was kind. She was politely spoken. She listened respectfully as I spoke with her. But you know, she was as lost can be. And you might be like that tonight. Hearing tonight about this place in which the Lord Jesus is to take up residence, and you yet in your sin never will live to see it. For you're under the condemnation of God. But the good news tonight is that the Lord wants you to be there. He wants you to be saved. He wants you to be counted among his people. And he wants you to enter into the joy of this destination and of this experience that will be common for Jew and Gentile in the coming kingdom age. Now, I don't know about you, I find this exciting. You see, the Lord is going to dwell there. And that excites me. And I want you to come back tomorrow evening, because tomorrow evening we're going to go into the very heart of this complex. And we're going to make some observations about the inner court. And I think, you know, you're going to hear some things that perhaps you've never even heard before. Certainly when I studied this for the first time, there were things that I thought, no, I've never heard anybody preach this. Nobody ever taught me this. And I was thrilled. And I hope you'll come tomorrow night and equally be thrilled at what God is laying out before us. But remember, the purpose of these details is not that just to inform us, but to transform us. They were given initially to shame apostate Jews into thinking aright. And they underscored the truth that God is a covenant-keeping God. You see, there are friends today who will say to us, no, look, the covenant that God made with the Jews is annulled. And all of the blessings have been transferred to the church. Do you realize what that does to the character of God? It makes him somehow unfaithful. A God who makes promises that he cannot keep or will not keep. This would be like me divorcing my wife and marrying another woman, and you meeting me and saying, well, listen, you made a commitment to that, to your wife in the first place. Why are you with this woman? And I said to you, well, I just transferred the promises to her. You say, what a ridiculous thing to say. How audacious to suggest that your marriage vows may be transferred to another woman besides your wife. And yet God made these promises to Israel. And friends, if he doesn't keep his promises to Israel, he's not keeping his promises to us. Do you understand that? God is a covenant-keeping God. He will not break his word. And our testimony rests upon his good character and not upon our performance or anything else of that ilk.
That's the good news for us all. He honors his promises. He doesn't shift them sidewards, even when those to whom he has given them, as in the case of these people, fall short of his glory. God is faithful. He will prove himself faithful to the Jew, and he will prove himself every bit as faithful to the believing Gentile. And so just as those held by Babylonian captivity were excited to shame and motivated to righteousness, we too would be wise to take stock of our lives and to think of all that the Lord has laid in store for us, of all that's been reserved on our behalf, both in heaven and on earth, so that we should too keep ourselves from idolatry and keep ourselves pure. May God bless these thoughts to your hearts this evening. Let's rise together as we sing our closing hymn.